A new report from the Disability Law Center accuses a private special education school in Middleborough of neglect and abuse. The report, revealed Monday on the Chamberlain International School, also said it's worried about oversight of all such schools serving special needs children.
We have a growing concern about students with disabilities across the Commonwealth being severely mistreated. It's our sense that the mistreatment of these youngsters with disabilities is not limited to public or private schools. It's not limited by geography. And we think it's a widespread problem.
When public school districts are not equipped to address the special needs of a student, they often turn to these private special ed programs. For parents, figuring out which of these private schools is the right fit for their child can be a complicated maze. These private schools are the focus of a just-completed investigation by WBUR News and the investigative journalism team, The Eye. This morning, WBUR's Shannon Dooling has this look at the network of schools for some of the state's most vulnerable students.
Let's head down to the end of the block so you guys can ride. All right? You can go ahead, bud.
It's one of the first days of summer vacation, and Marie's lanky 13-year-old son is cruising around their Norfolk neighborhood on his razor trike.
It's kind of the equivalent of an adult big wheel. And, executive functioning is a challenge, which means that learning to do something like ride a bike is a challenge.
We've agreed not to use Marie's last name because of her son's age and to protect his medical privacy. Her son was diagnosed with autism when he was 2 years old. He also has acute anxiety disorder. Marie began homeschooling her son in the second grade when the combination of academic and social pressures made the public school environment a difficult place for her son to learn. The boy was supposed to begin third grade at a special ed program in the Norfolk district. But when his behavior became increasingly aggressive, Marie says the school district could no longer accommodate him.
The school advised that instead of homeschooling or trying to bring him back into school, they felt it was best that we look for an outplacement.
There are about 6,000 publicly funded Massachusetts students, like Marie's son, in out-of-district placements at private special ed schools, commonly referred to as 766 schools, named after the state's special education law. If a public school district determines it cannot meet the needs of a special ed student, then the district is required by law to pay for an appropriate education elsewhere. Students at private special ed schools display a wide range of diagnoses, including autism, severe anxiety, or depression. James Major is executive director of the Massachusetts Association of 766 approved private schools. He says students at these schools have complex, severe disabilities, and that can make for a challenging academic environment.
They usually have failed repeatedly over and over and over again, and it's been incredibly frustrating for the kid. And our schools really represent the last hope, an opportunity for these kids.
According to state data, the number of special ed students with severe disabilities is increasing. Since 2003, enrollment of students with autism, for example, is up more than 300%. The number of students with severe neurological impairments is up almost 150% in that same time frame.
The numbers of kids with complex and severe disabilities is increasing in America and in Massachusetts, and it's increasing dramatically. And it's a real challenge to not only to our members, but to public school districts.
Marie says none of the special ed schools suggested by the Norfolk district were appropriate for her son. She says they either didn't accept students his age or didn't take students with his type of aggressive behavior. At that point, Marie and her husband had to do a lot of their own research, looking online and asking around to other parents. After trying one school, they ultimately pulled their son when he came home with bruising around his wrists. They began searching again.
There is no Yelp. I can't just go online and say, how is this school rated? There's nothing out there like that. We're talking about putting our child in a school where they may use restraints. And, it was very hard to find out information. Have there been any incidents with any of the children who have been put in restraints? Will my child be safe? And you have to pretty much wait and see what happens.
The 160-plus approved private special ed schools in Massachusetts are a mixture of residential and day programs, and they don't just serve in-state students. The system attracts about 1,500 out-of-state and international students, bringing $144 million in net revenue into the state, says the state's trade association. The Massachusetts special ed law was the first of its kind in the country, and the state is largely considered a leader in the field of special ed. But more than 40 years later, some officials and advocates worry that this groundbreaking system has grown into a web of fragmented oversight, making it difficult to easily share information that could potentially prevent mistreatment. The Disability Law Center, a nonprofit with federal authority to protect the rights of people with disabilities, issued a report this week documenting abuse and neglect at Chamberlain International School. The center also reported earlier in the year that it had found examples of neglect by staff at the Evergreen Center, a private special ed school in Milford, and serious mistreatment at a special ed program at the Peck School in Holyoke. Stan Eichner is the head litigator at the Law Center. He says the mistreatment of students at the Peck School was startling.
Students were mistreated by very large staff members. One student had been restrained again and, you know, many dozens of times. Many of the students had sustained physical injuries. It was just awful. And this is a public school.
In a statement, Dr. Stephen Dreich, the receiver of the Holyoke School District, says staff at the Peck School are receiving additional training, and there's been a steady decrease in the use of restraints in the program. Dreich says the school continues to cooperate with the Law Center. But at the private Eagleton School in Great Barrington, state licensing agencies found the culture of abuse to be beyond repair. The all-boys residential school was put on probation in February in response to allegations of staff punching students, refusing medical treatment, and verbally abusing the boys and young men. State regulators revoked the school's licenses in March, and the facility closed in April. 17 former Eagleton staffers now face criminal charges. Eichner says that school may be a reflection of a larger trend.
Eagleton represents the state, to some extent, waking up and saying, okay, we have to really do something. There are big, big problems there. Too many vulnerable students were subjected to conditions that weren't vigorously overseen or monitored by the state. That was perhaps a watershed moment.
Clearly, we've had some very difficult cases, and we want to learn from those experiences.
Maria Mosaides is director of the State Office of the Child Advocate. The office brought together representatives from seven state agencies involved with licensing and overseeing private special ed schools. The group is looking at what more can be done to ensure child safety.
I think the population of children that are now in these schools represent more acute cases than ever before. And so it is a good time to look at the protocols and say, are these sufficient to protect the children who are currently in these schools?
That effort includes interagency communication, particularly when it comes to sharing reports of abuse and neglect documented at residential schools.
We need to have a shared understanding of red flags. We're spending a lot of Commonwealth activity monitoring, but I don't think it's coordinated at the level that it needs to be.
The State Trade Association for Private Special Ed Schools is also looking at possible improvements, specifically at improving transparency around reporting mistreatment at schools. After hearing from WBUR and The Eye on this story that parents often struggle to find information about the schools, the group's board voted unanimously last month to approve a framework of proposed state legislation. The bill would call for greater public access to redacted investigation reports at special education schools and other institutions.
Let's see. That's the talent show.
Oh, the talent show. That's right. Love the talent show.
We did a music video. And I was also included in student council. That's me right there.
Back in Norfolk, flipping through her son's yearbook, It seems Marie and her husband did ultimately choose a great fit for their son. But Marie says it was a difficult road, and she's hopeful that maybe her family's experience can make it easier on other children.
Maybe I can point somebody in the direction of saying, this is how you find out about a school. These are the questions you want to ask when you go. You want to consider distance. These are your child's rights. Right now, there's not enough of that goes on.
and everybody's kind of in their own little silo. You know, we're all walking through the same maze, but we're not walking together.
And while the state works to improve communication and break down some of those silos, it remains difficult to know exactly what's waiting at the end of that maze. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Our reporting on private schools for special education students in Massachusetts was produced in partnership with The Eye, the news site of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. As we've been reporting this week, sometimes Massachusetts students who require certain special education services aren't able to get them in public schools because the public schools are not always equipped to meet the students' needs. James Major is executive director of an association of the private schools. His group is called MAPS.
They usually have failed repeatedly over and over and over again, and it's been incredibly frustrating for the kid. And our schools really represent the last hope and opportunity for these kids.
But who are the special education students in Massachusetts, and are they getting the assistance they need in both public and private schools? We spoke with Elizabeth Keefe, assistant professor at Lesley University, who focuses on special education and autism spectrum disorders, and asked her if the number of special education students in the state is growing.
The number of students that require special education services in the Commonwealth has remained largely static over the last 10 years. There's no question that there have been specific groups, such as students with autism, who have experienced, you know, a significant number of students with particular disabilities in our schools. So I would say the need for programming for students with very complex disabilities is certainly an issue in the Commonwealth.
Are we doing a better job at identifying children who need services?
The Commonwealth is a very progressive state with regard to special education and supporting students with disabilities. So I think we've actually always done a pretty good job of identifying the students that need services in the Commonwealth.
What about delivering services themselves? Is the Commonwealth doing a good job or an average job or a below average job in terms of actually delivering services to the children in need?
I would say we're doing an uneven job. We've always been a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of our offerings and our programming and our thinking with regard to the needs of students who have complex profiles, who have, you know, really unique set of learning characteristics. But we have an interesting system. So when public schools, for example, feel that they don't have the capacity to adequately provide educational programming for students, we have outplacements in Chapter 766 schools. These are our private special education schools in the Commonwealth. Some are stellar, continually working to improve the education of their staff, the preparation and training of their staff. And then we have schools who purport to meet the most complex needs of our most vulnerable population of students in the state who are not doing such a good job.
Do you think that's due to under-regulation by the state or parents of these students becoming more self-aware of what's right and what's wrong and then reporting out on that?
Probably a combination of factors, and it's not to say necessarily that the public system is better or superior to the private system, but there's a little bit more accountability with the public system. There's a little bit more transparency. The staff and teachers at private settings are not always required to have licenses, teaching licenses, or certifications. And I think overall, given the level of complexity of the students that are placed in these private settings, we do not have the capacity in some cases to oversee management of these private special education schools.
Does the state need to do more?
I believe there are a number of different things that we could be doing to improve the system. One is at the state level to ensure that we have adequate supervision at the state level. Secondly, we need to require and demand transparency from some of these Chapter 766 schools. including improving the preparation of the teachers that work there. And then lastly, to be working with families to support them where they are. It's really important not to vilify parents for, you know, the desire to place students at a school that purports to be able to meet the complex needs of their children.
And what can parents do to make sure they're choosing the right school for their children?
There's a lot of information that's publicly available on the Department of Education website. I think, you know, being a really good advocate means that you are really thoroughly doing your research about schools, reaching out to educators that, you know, you have a level of trust with, that you've worked with in the past to seek their opinions on particular placements. And really having candid conversations with the directors or the staff at school to ask the hard questions about things like, you know, safety of students, supervision, level of ratio of staff to students. Those are the kinds of questions parents should be asking and the advocates that they should be engaging in.
Professor Keefe, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Elizabeth Keefe focuses on special education and autism spectrum disorders at Lesley University. For all the stories in this series, go to the Edify section of our website, WBUR.org. It's time now for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the lives of those who've passed. This morning, writer Alyssa Eli has the story of a clinical psychologist from Sharon who went out of his way to support veterans.
Greg Offringa talked fluently, with zest, on almost any topic, fixing a garage door opener, single malt scotch, Buddhism. But unlike talkers who care most for their own company, he was also fluent at listening. People wanted to talk to him. Any form of prejudice went against his bones. Greg was that way growing up in Brockton, where he became the de facto bodyguard for a vulnerable best friend. And he was that way when he volunteered at 18 to enlist in the Vietnam War. Communists, as he saw them, represented the worst of prejudice and persecution. He explained it simply to his wife, Barbara Offringa.
He just didn't like a bully. Never did.
He remained a committed humanist after returning from a tour as a helicopter gunner, but trauma had unnerved him. Long before the diagnosis became familiar, he struggled with nightmares and sky-high blood pressure. For the rest of his life, he faced outwards in restaurants. But his fluency for talking and listening hadn't disappeared, nor had his belief in the goodness of people. This led to the next career, clinical psychologist, treating others with trauma. Mostly he saw vets. Those from Vietnam had returned to a hostile, uncomprehending homeland, and Greg countered the judgment they met with absolute acceptance.
You are fighting, A, to stay alive, and B, to help the person next to you stay alive. There's a camaraderie that I don't think we can understand unless we've been there.
In camaraderie, Greg once rode his motorcycle cross-country for a disabled American veterans fundraiser. But he didn't tell Barbara many stories about combat.
He told me if our son was going to volunteer, it would be over his dead body. He would not let our son go anywhere near anything militaristic.
The joys of life as a civilian took over, raising two children with Barbara, a monthly poker game that stretched over 30 years, making friends on the commuter rail to Boston. But the war followed him. Growths in his larynx from Agent Orange required multiple surgeries. Eventually, his vocal cords were so damaged he had to buy a microphone to be understood by one hard-of-hearing patient. The war followed him in another way, too.
When he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, we were driving home after the diagnosis, and he just said to me, "I think I'm going to just face this cancer the way I face combat. You go in. You do your job. You don't think about whether you're going to die or live. You just do your job."
Chemotherapy was just the job. The people in his life were the purpose. It was as if, during his time in combat, he hadn't expected to survive long enough to find them. When he did, he wasn't about to let them go.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Greg Offringa, who died in June last year. To suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org.